Good afternoon, everyone. The Labor, Industry, and Veterans and Military Affairs Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. I would like to announce that this meeting will take place in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This may be viewed on House Public Information TV, which is available on the House website. As is custom with this committee, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance. Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Ms. Doyle, take the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Present.
Vice Chair Zhang.
Present.
Representative Detmer is excused. Representative McDonald. Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Bliss.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Greenman.
Present.
Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Raleigh.
Present.
Representative Sundin.
Present.
Representative McDonald. And we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Doyle. Next on the agenda is approval of minutes from the February 3rd, 2021 meeting. Every member should have received a copy of today's minutes in their inbox. Seeking a motion for the approval of the minutes. Representative McDonald, did you have a chance to check over the minute? Oh, he's not here. Representative Green, did you have a chance to look over the minutes?
Do you mean me, Representative Greenman?
Greenman, I'm sorry.
yes, I moved the minutes.
Last committee was a tough one. Representative Green was in that one. Representative Greenman, I apologize. Representative Greenman moves the minutes from the February 3rd, 2021 minutes. Any objections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion carries. We'll see if we can get this committee on schedule. First item on the agenda today is an overview from the Bureau of Mediation Services and a presentation on their budget proposal. With us today is Deputy Commissioner Michael Stockstead to do this presentation. Commissioner Stockstead, please identify yourself for the record and proceed. You'll have to unmute yourself, Commissioner. Commissioner Stockstead, please down and proceed. Commissioner, we're having some kind of audio troubles. We are not hearing you. I don't know if I see you're unmuted on the screen, but the sound is not coming through. The joys of technology. Travis, do you know if the Department of Labor Industry would be ready while we try to work with Mr. Stockstead to try to get his audio working?
Yeah, I believe Commissioner Robertson is here and they're ready to go. I don't know if Deputy Commissioner Stockstead, if you want to like leave the hearing, come back, and maybe that'll work, sort of like a restart or something. We'll move on to Dolly and then come back to BMS then.
Okay, we'll try that. Commissioner Robert.
Mr. Chair, now you're muted.
Maybe we should just start over today, folks. We'll try that. But anyway, now I'm unmuted. Next on the agenda is from Department of Labor Industry. Commissioner Robertson is here with a presentation on the governor's budget proposal. Commissioner Robertson, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair,
For the record, my name is Roslyn Robertson. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. To begin, I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee members for inviting me to present an overview of the governor's budget recommendations for the Department of Labor and Industry. The Department of Labor and Industry mission is to ensure Minnesota work and living environments are equitable, healthy, and safe. The agency vision is to be a trusted resource and impartial regulator for employers, employees, property owners, and other stakeholders. I will briefly describe the functions of each unit before getting into the budget presentations. The agency has four primary program areas, and it also have a number of workforce development programs that I will describe. First, we have the workers' compensation program. This program ensures appropriate benefits are delivered to injured workers efficiently and at a reasonable cost. The vision strives to create an environment where injured workers promptly receive benefits and services and where the system operate efficiently and cost effectively. Next, we have the Occupational Safety and Health Program, Minnesota OSHA. This program helps keep Minnesota workplaces safe and healthy through activities performed by both the compliance unit and the consultation unit. The compliance unit completes its work through workplace inspections and investigations. The consultation unit works with employers who are interested in voluntarily addressing workplace safety and health issues. Next, we have the Labor Standards Program. This program protects workers and promote compliance through enforcement and outreach about wage, hours, and employment laws. Next, we have apprenticeship. The apprenticeship unit promotes and facilitates the development of quality registered apprenticeship programs that help Minnesota employers recruit, train, and retain a highly skilled and diverse workforce. It conducts compliance reviews to ensure the protections and advancement of apprentices in their training throughout the program. Next, we have the Construction Code and Licensing Division. That unit protects public health and safety through the enforcement of reasonable and uniform construction code standards, focused on improving efficiencies in the delivery of inspections, permitting, licensing, and other construction regulatory services to industry stakeholders. Next, we have the Dual Training Pipeline Program. This program supports employers in building their own dual training program, strategically combining related instructions with on-the-job training to ensure a skilled workforce. It targets four high-growth industry sectors with limited experience in registered apprenticeship. These sectors include advanced manufacturing, agriculture, healthcare services, and information technology. Then we have the Youth Skill Training Program, the third of our workforce development programs. This program supports the development of partnerships between education and employers to provide students 16 years of age and older with classroom instruction, safety training, and paid work experience in high growth, high demand occupations. And then finally, we have our general support division, which performs support functions, including communication, financial services, human resources, legal services, outreach and education, research and statistics, and combative sports. Labor and industry-based budget for fiscal year 22 through 23 is $223 million. Of the $223 million budget, only $8.89 million is of general funds, which supports labor standards, pipelines, and IT modernization, which will end in fiscal year 23. The majority of funding for the agency comes from the workers' compensation and the construction code funds. This pie chart shows expenditures by program. Workers' compensation, benefits, and CCLD are the largest expenditure areas, accounting for more than 50% of total spending. Now I will discuss the governor's budget change items for labor and industry. Next. The governor proposed 12 budget items impacting labor and industry, totaling $7.3 million across various funds. The largest request is a fee reduction for construction code and licensing fees and permits. $3.5 million, or 1.6% of the agency budget, are requests for ongoing increases to the department-based budget. I will present details of the 12 governor recommendations in the following slides. First, the governor proposes an operating increase for the Minnesota Occupational Safety and Health Program, Minnesota OSHA. The increase would fund an additional 9.5 full-time equivalents to maintain a state program as effective as federal OSHA. This is a request to maintain current services and to add additional staff to handle the increase in stakeholder inquiries, complaints, and requests for assistance. Increasing the number of safety and health investigators will enable Minnesota OSHA to maintain its mission to protect workers at private and public work sites within Minnesota and prevent workplace injuries, illnesses, and fatalities. The ongoing $903,000 represent a 21.7% increase in the state appropriation funding. Minnesota OSHA has seen a considerable decline in full-time equivalents from 75 positions in 2012 to 62 FTEs in today, putting the Minnesota OSHA program at risk of losing its as effective as status and hindering Minnesota OSHA to effectively meet its statutory obligations. Since fiscal year 2012, total funds available to expend between state and federal resources have only increased 4.5%. However, the operating costs per FTE have increased 21.35%. The variance in the operating costs increases and the lack of increases to available funds have resulted in declining FTEs from 75 FTEs down to 62 FTEs today. Next, the governor recommends an increase. Next, the governor recommends, proposes legislation to raise the maximum penalties for willful, repeat, serious, non-serious, and failure to correct and posting violations of workplace safety standards to conform to federal law. It also would tie future penalties to the Minneapolis, St. Paul, Bloomington, Minnesota, Wisconsin Consumer Price Index for all urban consumers. The increase in total penalties will vary from year to year, but on average, the change represents a 2% increase in penalties. This proposal will make the state's penalty maximum comparable to federal and other state program penalty maximums. If Minnesota does not make the change, it risks continued federal OSHA funding. Losing federal funding would result in the state forfeiting the OSHA administration to the Federal Department of Labor. Then the higher federal penalties would go into effect without any mitigating factors that Minnesota OSHA currently consider. This change would also result in 750,000 state and local government employees not having OSHA coverage. Next. The governor recommends an increase of $203,000 for fiscal year 21 general fund operating appropriation and additional funding of $51,000 in fiscal year 22 and $101,000 in each subsequent year from the general fund to maintain the current level of service delivery at the Department of Labor and Industry. This represents a 1.1% increase in fiscal year 22 and a 2.2% increase in fiscal year 23 to Labor and Industries General Fund appropriation. The fiscal year 21 operating reduction amount reflects savings generated due to the state hiring freeze and other operating efficiencies in the current year. The operating increases recommended in fiscal year 22 and 23 fund a portion of projected cost increases in the upcoming biennium. Each year, the costs of doing business continue to rise, including growing costs for employer-paid health care contributions and other salary and compensation-related costs. Other operating costs like rent, lease, fuel, and utilities, IT, and legal services also continue to increase. This cost growth puts pressure on agency operating budgets that remain flat from year to year without enacted increases. Next. The governor proposes to extend fee reductions that were enacted into law in 2015 and extended in to 2017. This includes license fees for construction contractors, electricians, plumbers, high-pressure pipe fitters, and boiler operators, as well as building permits and plan review fees. Extending the fee reductions will allow individuals and business licensees to continue paying less while providing sufficient revenues to the department to cover program costs. The proposed extension is for 2 years to determine how the current economic recovery will impact the construction industry. Extending the fee reduction would result in a revenue decrease of approximately $2,250,000 in fiscal years 22 and 23. The Construction Code and Licensing Division has sought to keep its fees in line with the cost of providing services for which the fees are paid. Construction Code and Licensing revenues is highly dependent upon the overall health of the construction industry. If the construction industry slows considerably, the revenue from the reduced fees would not be sufficient to sustain the vital services provided. Therefore, this proposal is to extend the fee reduction for only the next 2 years, at which time DLI will reassess and make its recommendations. Next. The governor proposes increasing the frequency of contractor recovery payout and the amount of funds available to homeowners who have suffered a financial loss due to a licensed contractor fraudulent, deceptive, or dishonest practices. The proposal is to raise the maximum payout limit per licensed residential building contractor or the licensee from $300,000 to $800,000, thus minimizing the chance that the homeowner claim would have to be prorated. The increased cap will result in an estimated $246,000 in additional payouts per year to impacted homeowners. The current language, which limit fund payout to once a year, unnecessarily prolongs a homeowner's recovery. If a homeowner misses the June deadline for making application to the recovery fund and applies in July or after, they will not receive compensation from the contractor recovery fund for almost a year and a half. Changing the payout and the application deadlines to occur within the same fiscal year would also result in a more straightforward way to manage the fund. There are times when claims by multiple owners or lessees against a single contractor exceed the current cap. In these instances, the commissioner must prorate the claim, resulting in them receiving far less than the amount of their out-of-pocket loss. Increasing the maximum payout per licensee will allow for more homeowners to more closely recover their out-of-pocket costs when a licensee failed to perform their contractual obligations. The Contractor Recovery Fund is supported through fees added on to the residential building contractor licensees. Since fiscal year 12, the average amount of recoveries paid out of the contractor recovery fund is $1.79 million annually. Next. The governor proposes expanding access to unpaid pregnancy and parental leave, school conferences, and activity leaves, accrued sick leave benefits for the care of relatives, and safety leave and pregnancy accommodation laws. The changes strengthens Minnesota law to ensure more workers have access to unpaid time off and pregnancy accommodations in the workplace. The governor proposes $84,000 in fiscal year 22 would be for outreach and education to employers and employees on the law changes, and $34,000 ongoing for enforcement and compliance activities. The $34,000 ongoing increase represents a 1% increase to the Labor Standards Division, which enforces all labor laws. The Family Medical Leave Act applies to employees who work for an employer with 50 or more employees, and the Minnesota Leave Accommodation Law applies to employees who work for an employer with 21 or more employees. Approximately 20% of Minnesotans work for an employer with fewer than 21 employees, and therefore aren't covered either by Minnesota various leave laws or the Family Medical Leave Act due to their employer size. Both the Family Medical Leave Act and the Minnesota law require an employee to have worked for that employer for at least 12 months in order to be eligible for leave. These stringent requirements leave a number of workers without the right to take employer sick leave for the care of themselves or relatives or safety leave. The Minnesota Supreme Court is currently considering whether the 12-month employment requirements applies to pregnancy accommodation rights. The proposal changes the parenting leave and accommodation law to reduce the employer size from 21 or more to one or more employees. The attachment requirement for pregnancy and parenting leave, as well as sick leave, are reduced from 12 months to 90 days, and the attachment requirement for pregnancy accommodation is clarified at 0 days. Next. The governor proposes amending the Women Economic Security Act statutes to better support lactation by ensuring employees can take the time needed to pump at work without losing pay. Changes include requiring break time to be paid, eliminating the ability for employers to opt out, and updating language to make the law more gender neutral. $84,000 in fiscal year 22 would be for outreach and education to employers and employees on the law change, and $34,000 ongoing would be for ongoing enforcement and compliance activities. The ongoing $34,000 per year is a 1% increase to the labor standards budget, which enforces labor laws. Current law requires reasonable unpaid break time for women to pump. However, the department proposes this break time be paid so employees don't have to make the difficult choice between getting paid and continuing to pump in the workplace. DLI proposes removing language from the law that provides an opt-out for employers if providing break time would unduly disrupt the operations of the employer. Next. The governor proposes requiring employers to provide up to 80 hours of paid sick leave for healthcare providers to use for qualified COVID-19 related reasons. These critical frontline workers are frequently excluded from the paid leave provisions of the Federal Family First Coronavirus Response Act, which did not apply to employers with over 500 employees and allowed employers to exclude healthcare providers from eligibility for leave. All leave hours used by employees for qualified COVID-19 related reasons following enactment of this bill must be paid at the employee's regular rate of pay. The law would be in effect for the duration of the state's peacetime emergency or June 30th, 2021, whichever occurs first. The department would be responsible for outreach and education of employers and employees on the law change and would have compliance and enforcement authority in addition to providing employees a private right of action. This proposal requires employers to provide up to 80 hours of paid time off to employees at the employee's regular rate of pay if the employee is unable to work or telework for qualifying reasons. Next. The Climate Change Subcabinet Commercial Energy Code Improvements. This proposal aligns with the agency's statutory responsibility to adopt model commercial energy code and consider amendments to the code to improve the efficiency of a building. The proposal recommends adoption of a new model commercial energy code, which it is issued every 3 years, beginning with the adoption of the international ASRAE standard 90.1 through 2019. Because the model code alone would likely be insufficient to achieve net zero by 2036, subsequent code adoption would include an adjusted minimal percent efficiency or an equivalent set of enhancement to meet that goal. The agency anticipates this change to cost $145,000 every 3 years beginning in fiscal year 23, $45,000 to conduct rulemaking and $100,000 to conduct a market and cost analysis to determine necessary energy efficiency performance enhancement. Next. Dual training competency grant transfer. This proposal recommends reducing the annual $200,000 appropriation for dual training competency grants from the Office of Higher Education base budget and adding it to the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry base budget beginning in fiscal year 22. The dual training competency grants administered by the Minnesota Office of Higher Education was established in 2015 to support the implementation of the Minnesota Dual Training Pipeline administered by the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. Pipeline exists to support employers in creating or enhancing a competency-based dual training approach where workers receive a combination of related instructions strategically paired with the on-the-job training. The dual training grant supplies the funding for the related instructions, and DLI provides added support to the Office of Higher Education in areas of outreach, grantee training, and monitoring. Additionally, Labor and Industry and the Office of Higher Ed coordinate on maintaining a related instruction training provider inventory, which must be posted on our website. This inventory is maintained and hosted by Labor and Industry. Next. Information technology modernization reductions. The governor recommends reducing the IT modernization appropriation by $848,000 over the course of two fiscal years. DLI received $2.8 million in modernization funds between fiscal year 20 and fiscal year 23. To update agency applications running on age technology that will run out of vendor support beginning in January of 2021. DLI received IT modernization funds due to many of DLI applications being reliant upon old technology that will run out of vendor support. The code used within the applications is outdated and not used by current IT workforce. The risk of doing nothing was operating DLI business processes on unsupported applications, which could increase cybersecurity vulnerabilities and over time will degrade service delivery. The COVID-19 pandemic, along with a vacant minute and business positions unfilled due to the hiring freeze. It delayed DLI's progress on system modernization. DLI and Minute are in the process of moving software off unsupported platforms. However, progress on replacing the software systems themselves are lagging behind schedule. We will continue to work within the remaining funds to update and ensure that our technologies are secure. Next. The last proposal is the paid family and medical leave insurance. The governor recommends creating a new Minnesota family and medical leave program, which will be administered by DEED. This program will provide wage replacement for family and medical leave and will provide job protection for recipients, so they are assured of continued employment with their employer upon their return. Premiums collected will fund the program and ongoing administrative costs. Paid family medical leave is a program that most employees will need at one point, but approximately 26% of all family and medical leaves do not include any wage replacement at this time. According to the Family Medical Leave Insurance, options for designing and implementing a Minnesota program, which was released in February of 2016, around 10% of Minnesota workers take a family or medical leave in any given year. 59% of current leaves in Minnesota are for an employee's own health reasons other than pregnancy. 17% are for bonding for new parents, and 24% of leaves are for caretaking of seriously ill family members. The majority of the program and budget for this initiative will be under DEED. DLI, however, would receive $1.046 million in fiscal year 22 and 23, and $1.086 million in fiscal year 23 through 25 for the Department of Labor and Industry for oversight and compliance costs related to the program, as well as an IT systems upgrade. That concludes my formal presentation. I will be happy to answer any questions. I also have our Chief Financial Officer, Christy Swanson, here with me today for additional questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Robertson, for the presentation. Is there any member questions? I see Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I listened to your presentation. I'm trying to understand how many FTEs will be added as a total FTD addition, and how many dollars this adds to your budget totally.
Commissioner Robertson.
Mr. Chair, certainly the very first proposal would add 9.5 FTEs. The remaining proposals, I think collectively, let me see. We're not adding individual FTEs beyond that. For nursing and lactating mothers, there is a 1/4 or 25% FTE. For improving rights to unpaid leave and pregnancy accommodations, 1/4 FTE. No FTEs for the contractor recovery fund, no FTEs for the fee, the construction code fee reductions, none for that. From my quick read, and maybe my staff can pipe in if I'm overlooking something, of all of the budget proposals, this would add 10 FTEs with 9.5 FTEs for the OSHA program and a half-time FTE to the labor standards program.
Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. And my second part of that question was, how many dollars does this add to your total budget? How many dollars, and what's the percent of increase on the total budget?
Commissioner Robertson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'd have to do some quick math. Maybe the staff can help me out if they have added these up.
This is Christy Swanson. I can...
Ms. Swanson. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Sure, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Christy Swanson. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for Labor and Industry. The total impact to the total fiscal impact of the budget proposals is $7.3 million. But as the commissioner indicated, a lot of that are fee reductions and other reductions to the budget. So the total ongoing increase to the labor and industry would be $3.5 million, and that is 1.6% of the agency operating budget.
Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. Mr. Chair, I've got a question on the compliance costs and then the IT systems. So I'll go to the compliance costs first. On the, I believe the last slide that the commissioner showed us, There was a $1.046 million that was budgeted for compliance costs and IT systems upgrades. If the commissioner could, Mr. Chair, compliance with whom or with what?
Commissioner Robertson.
Mr. Chair, this represents compliance with the paid family medical leave insurance. The as we indicated, this program will be administered by deed in terms of collecting the I don't want to use the word tax, collecting the fee to support the program. That portion will be administered by deed. However, DLI would receive that $1.046 million for the Department for Oversight and Compliance Costs related to the program. So in this instance, much like other labor laws that are in that are administered by the Labor Standards Unit, this portion of the that policy provision would be administered by Labor and Industry. It would also support an IT system upgrade.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate that. So specifically on the IT systems, is this a capital equipment investment or is this a software investment? And so that's the question, please.
Commissioner Robertson.
Is this
or Ms. Swanson?
Yeah, really.
Chrissy, can you help me out there?
Sure. Yep, this is Chrissy Swanson. This would be developing, this would be a software investment. So new software to track or adding on to existing software to track these type of activities that the department has not yet done before. So it wouldn't be capital so much as software, building out software or enhancing software.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got one follow-up on that and then one final question. So is the software, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Is the software bespoke software or is this like off-the-shelf commercial software?
Ms. Swanson.
This would most likely be adding on to existing software, just adding additional fields and components and aspects we need for this type of enforcement activity, which is has been purchased off the shelf and customized for the agency.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And then finally, this will probably be a little bit broader question, but as I read through the budget and as I read through the proposal, I'm trying to get a sense for what the economic impact is going to be on the small businesses that are going to be asked to comply with some of these or with the totality of all of these recommendations. Do we have a sense for what is going to be the impact on small businesses that are covered by this budget and then the changes that are being requested?
Commissioner Robertson.
Mr. Chair, I don't have an analysis right at my fingertip. The areas that does create an obligation on behalf of the employer includes the 80 hours of leave time for the healthcare workers during this COVID time and the paid leave time for nursing mothers, for lactating mothers in the workplace. The other provisions, I don't believe have a negative impact on small businesses. And I don't know that we have measured out what those exact costs are.
Representative Raleigh.
Mr. Chair, I would really like to thank the commissioner for this excellent presentation. This is really great information. I think this is gives us a lot better understanding of how the organization is basically set up and what the impacts are going to be. So I would ask that if there is an impact study or if there is data like that, that is done between now and, if one is done, I would appreciate it if it would be shared with the committee and with myself, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Raleigh and Commissioner Robertson. Ms. Swanson, I'm sure you can get that information to the committee as it becomes available. I don't see any member questions. Commissioner Robertson, Ms. Swanson, thank you for your time on this on the budget proposal, and thank you for the good work you do protecting the workers and employers in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you for having us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next on the agenda is Deputy Commissioner Michael Stockstead from the Bureau of Mediation Services. Let's see if we have our audio working now. Commissioner Stockstead, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mike Stockstead. I'm the Deputy Commissioner with the Bureau of Mediation Services. Thank you for the opportunity to come before your committee today. The Bureau of Mediation Services is a neutral agency, neutral state agency that deals with all labor relations in the state. We serve the state of Minnesota, all of its agencies and departments, all state boards and commissions, the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, the University of Minnesota, all Minnesota counties, all Minnesota cities, all Minnesota townships that have public employees, all charitable hospitals, all public nursing homes, every school district. We also service some private and parochial schools, all public utilities, all public employee labor unions, some private employee labor unions, and then all state employees or all public employees within the state of Minnesota have direct access where there is no union involved through independent review. The services we provide is that we assist parties in resolving collective bargaining disputes. We assist in the resolution of grievance disputes. We resolve questions of labor union representation and bargaining unit structure. We train and facilitate labor management committees. We also train and facilitate groups in interest collective bargaining. We develop and maintain three arbitrator lists, a general list, a teacher discharge list, and now the peace officer discipline list. We receive and catalog and provide access to all arbitration awards issued in Minnesota. And then for public employees, like I said, with the independent review, those who do not have union contracts, we are the neutral third party that process disputes over grievances and discipline. Our structure is we have a commissioner and a deputy commissioner. We have nine mediators. We have two support staff who are also representation specialists. We have one state program administrative principal who currently is working on rulemaking and the information transfer from all of our paper files into electronic files. Our mediators are cross-trained and provide services in all aspects of training, representation, and mediation. And then due to the sheer workload, the commissioner and the deputy commissioner also participate in each of these functions. We currently have two unfilled positions in that structure. In fiscal year 2000, we processed 2,850 petitions, which accounted for 1,200 in-service or on-site meetings. Also 120 training and facilitations, along with 30 representation hearings and pre-hearings. The budget that is presented for this coming fiscal year has a minor budget increase to accommodate for the employee compensation increases, our known rent increases, IT support, which I could have used earlier, apparently, our fleet cost increases, and then our service growth. We're backlogged, obviously, with all that has been going on. But more than that, historically, anytime we're coming out of an economic downturn, the request for service goes way up. In 2021, the fiscal 21, we did have a decrease of $102,000, which were accomplished through hiring delays, modifications in our low-level mediation practices, along with a reduction in the amount of grants and an underutilized grant program. For fiscal 22-23, the governor is recommending one change item, and that is an $870,000 appropriation for the Public Employment Relations Board. This is a board that is independent of the Bureau, and it handles unfair labor practices. It was established in 2014 and then has had annual delays until this past July, when they went operational with a $125,000 budget. Our total budget ask for the 22-23 biennium is $5.655 million, which is a minor increase, like I said, in the operating budget, and then the $870,000 in the PERB increase. Mr. Chair, I'd stand for any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Stockstead. Any member questions of the commissioner? Representative Raleigh.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for allowing me a couple questions. I was trying to go through and write down all of the numbers. What was the original budget allocation in 2014 to establish the PERB?
Mr. Stockstead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Raleigh, the original allocation was $125,000, and that's been carried for each biennium going forward. Initially, the $125,000 was actually appropriated to the Bureau to assist in the development of the rules, establishment of the board, getting them some assistance or clerical support in getting their website up and running and the office organized.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then what is the $870,000 for? If we've got 125 that was originally allocated, how does the 870,000 come in?
Mr. Stockstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Raleigh. That number represents the costs that are going to be incurred for conducting the hearings. This is a pretty unique hearing methodology that is charged to the board, in that they have to have certain qualifications for their hearing officers. All hearings have to be transcribed. All of the decisions are immediately appealed to the board, and then can go from appeal to that. There's a process for each of those, which ends up covering the $870,000 with the figured number of cases that they're going to actually receive.
Representative Raleigh.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I understood that correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong on this one, the $870,000 along with the $125,000 is approximately about $1 million. Is that a characterization of what it's going to cost per year, or is this a one-time cost?
Commissioner Stockstead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Raleigh, that is a biennium cost. So
biennium.
Yes, sir.
Representative Raleigh.
Commissioner, is the PERB up and running at this point?
Commissioner Stockstead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Raleigh, yes, they are. They began operation in July of this year.
Commissioner Raleigh, or Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. And just the only comment I'd make on that is, heck of a time to get started. Do we see, and last question, if you will, Mr. Chair, do we see an increase beyond the, and I'm sorry, it's a two-part question. Is the $870,000 for the biennium inclusive of the $125,000 that was allocated? And then the second question is, do we have an idea, and I know this is tough from July until now, do we have an idea if that cost is going to increase over time because of the lessons learned since the opening of the PERV.
Mr. Stockstead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Raleigh, the first question, yes, that is inclusive of the $125,000. As far as the second part of the question, from what we have seen thus far, there has been an increase from what had been anticipated originally. Judging from the other states that have these types of offices or boards, that number should increase or will probably increase over time.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Sorry, one follow-up to that one. How many cases have been heard since July?
Mr. Stockstead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Raleigh, actually no cases have been heard as of this time. The petitions that have come in, the majority of those, the board has asked some of our mediators to try and rectify or at least meet with the parties and see if something couldn't be worked out. We've been successful in most all of those cases. I believe there is one case that is scheduled for a hearing at this point and two other cases that they are investigating.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Got to unmute myself here. Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on that. The part of the reason why the PERV board got started in July is that during the special sessions and during the end of the last session, Representative Lyndon Carlson had bills and I was carrying some bills for him to again extend it out till they got till the PERV board got funded. The reason why the PERV board is important is that it actually saves not only the state money, but it saves the local unions money. Because instead of going to the PERV board and getting these things worked out, as was said through some mediation and talks, that they can do it, try and get some agreement and get them worked out, but they don't end up in court, where without the PERV board, these cases could end up in court and therefore cost the state of Minnesota a lot more money than the cost of having the PERV board. And there will be a bill coming forward to fund them. It's at the revisor's office right now.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Any Representative Sundin, you had your hands up. I see you took them down. If you have any comments, you can.
Thank you, Chair Eklund. My questions were answered organically through the committee. Thank you.
I don't see any other commission questions from members. Commissioner Stockstead, thank you for the presentation. And as somebody in my former life as running some collective bargaining agreements, I appreciate the work that your agency has done to help out a lot of people across the state. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for the kind words.
Next up, final item on today's agenda is House File 334. Representative Frederick, could you please move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 334 be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. Representative Frederick moves his bill to be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. You may present the bill, and I believe Commissioner Robertson and staff is here to present us from the department as well. Representative Frederick, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill is pretty straightforward. It's got four different parts on it. It was working in collaboration with the department on these four different parts. One is an OSHA citation piece. The second piece is data pertaining to minors in the workforce and making sure that the loophole that existed is closed. And so that data is now, the intention is to classify that data as protected data. Just an effort to protect the information of minors in the workforce. The third piece would be talking about federal conformity with apprenticeships, and the fourth one is adding a couple positions to the Construction Advisory Council. So I will let the commissioner go into detail on those.
Commissioner Robertson, do you have any further comments? Please identify yourself again for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rosalyn Robertson. I'm the commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. As Representative Frederick indicated, we have four proposals in the DLI omnibus bill. The first proposal is to improve the transparency of OSHA citation data. DLI proposed this legislation that would classify Minnesota OSHA citations data as public as soon as Minnesota OSHA received confirmation that the employer has received the citation. The proposal would allow Minnesota OSHA to provide timely information to the public and its stakeholders about its enforcement activities, which would encourage employers to take the necessary steps to keep their employees safe. Additionally, this legislation would align Minnesota OSHA with the vast majority of state plan programs, and it also align it with the operations of federal OSHA. The current situation with Minnesota OSHA citations is that labor and industry is prohibited from releasing information regarding citations or any activity around an investigation until investigations are fully adjudicated. And although Minnesota OSHA is prohibited from releasing that information, as part of our agreement with federal OSHA and being a state plan state, we're obligated to provide that information to federal OSHA when citations are issued. So how the process works is when an investigation is completed and citations are appropriate, we complete the investigatory file and we issue citations. When we issue those citations, we are obligated to communicate that to federal OSHA. When federal OSHA receives that information, they post the information on their website. However, Minnesota is not able to do the same. We believe by posting the information or making the information available would encourage other like employees or even employees in the same or similar geographic area. We would want to use that as a means to encourage them to prioritize safety and to voluntarily address safety and health in the workplace. As it stands now, when these citations are issued, it often takes quite a long time before cases are fully adjudicated. We're also aware that, like federal OSHA that publishes citations far more sooner, Minnesota is one of only four plans, OSHA plans, that do not make citations information available to the general public. Minnesota OSHA is one of 22 state plans, state plan programs. Of those 22, Alaska, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, and Minnesota do not make citations available more promptly. All other 18 of the state plan states and all of federal OSHA, which operates in 8 states and territories, all make this information available. The next provision is child labor data protection. DLI is proposing that certain personal data collected about minors in child labor matters be deemed private, not public, as defined in Minnesota statute, chapter 13.02, subdivision 12. The agency found that there's no current protection of a minor's personal data that is collected or maintained by DLI for child labor exemption work applications. Just as many organizations, be it the court systems or otherwise, just as entities protect minors and protect information collected on minors, DLI is seeking the same, that we be allowed to maintain that information as not public information. Labor industry, specifically the Labor Standards Unit, is charged with the administration and enforcement of child labor regulations, including the responsibility of issuing child labor exemption permits. And we believe that the information collected in this process, the personal information that is collected, should be deemed as non-public information. The next provision is the Construction Code Advisory Council. The department is proposing to add two new members to the Construction Code Advisory Council. Currently, this is a 16-member council that discuss and address and provide advice to the commissioner on the construction codes. We're seeking to add an energy member and an accessibility member to the council. We believe by adding these two subject matter experts, it will enrich the council and enrich the advice that the council provides to the commissioner. The last proposal is the apprenticeship federal conformity language. This, the department proposes a legislative change to update the apprenticeship regulations to conform with federal apprenticeship requirements that promote equal employment opportunity protection for apprentices and applicants in registered apprenticeship programs. Similar to the OSHA program, the Minnesota Apprenticeship Program is the state recognized agency that's charged with the administration and regulations of apprenticeship. The department, in order to maintain its recognition from the Federal Department of Labor Office of Apprenticeship, is required to conform its statutory language to meet the federal requirements. DLI must make efforts to conform to Federal Regulations 2930, which outlines the equal employment opportunity regulations and support inclusive workplace workforce behavior and protections against discrimination. We have been notified by the Office of Apprenticeship that conformity is a requirement for that office to continue to recognize Minnesota apprenticeship as the state approving agency. So this is direction from the Federal Department of Labor Office of Apprenticeship. And that concludes the explanation of the proposals.
Thank you, Commissioner. We have a couple of testifiers. First up would be Stephanie Menning from Minnesota Utility Contractors Association. Ms. Menning, please identify yourself for the record and proceed. Ms. Menning, you're muted.
Thank you, Chair Eklund. My name is Stephanie Menning, and I am the Executive Director for the Minnesota Utility Contractors Association, or MUCA. I represent over 135 utility contractor and vendor companies across the state of Minnesota. The members of MUCA are responsible for construction of our critical underground infrastructure that Minnesotans use every day, such as clean water, stormwater drainage, sewer, wastewater infrastructure, gas, electric, telecom, and other utilities. On behalf of the members of MUCA, I am here to express our deep concern and opposition to House File 334 in its attempt to publish any alleged OSHA citations at the time of issuance. Publication of issued citations does not take into consideration any due process, including the ability of the accused to face their accuser prior to any determinations being made public. Building a good business reputation takes years and even generations. Many MUCA members have been in business for several decades in an industry that is inherently dangerous. Safety of their workers is the centerpiece of their culture, as if they are family, and many of them are. Dad is the owner, the son is operating the backhoe, and the nephew is in the ditch. They are concerned that this may unjustly tarnish their lifelong established reputations in an instant. They would prefer a window of opportunity to ensure any published data is valid and not in a contested status, voided, or perhaps thrown out after a thorough investigation is concluded. While the intention of this language may be to encourage other employers to comply, I would ask the committee to consider the negative method in which this encouragement may be received. All we seek is an opportunity for redress prior to publication. Justice requires an opportunity for the accuser to face the accused before the citation is definitely ruled as an actual violation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Manning. Please stick around in case there's any questions. Next up is Adam Hansen, Associated Builders and Contractors. Mr. Hansen, please state yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Eklund. My name is Adam Hansen. I'm with the Associated Builders and Contractors of Minnesota. Our contractor members and the men and women they employ are part of the 80% of the construction industry in the state that choose to be merit shop craft professionals. They build our schools, our medical facilities, our restaurant and retail establishments, multifamily housing, clean energy projects like solar and wind, and so much more. Our contractors have registered apprenticeship programs through the Department of Labor and Industry, some through the Federal Department of Labor, and others have customized and unique training programs built around their particular type of work. ABC also has an industry-leading partnership with MinOSHA and the Department of Labor and Industry that goes back to 2004 that is centered around a culture of safety, reducing workplace injuries, illness, and fatalities, as well as to continue the positive relationship between MinOSHA, ABC, and our members. The partnership has been a great success, with many of our general contractor and subcontractor members year after year choosing to enter their projects into the compliance partnership program. I'm testifying today, however, in opposition to one section of the bill, section 5, that relates to the citation data being made public, which begins on line 2.26. Current law and practices that we heard already make citation records timely and readily available through Federal OSHA's public website. Anybody can search the site for citations listed by employer, project zip code, date range, and a whole host of other classifications and records. From there, any member of the public can see if the investigation is open or closed, the type of penalty or fine that may have been issued, as well as the union affiliation or lack of the contractor at issue. Current law in the state also requires a contract subject to a citation to post that citation for at least 20 days on their job site at or near where the alleged violation occurred. One clause in the section of the bill that would be made public from a citation is, quote, the description of the nature of the violation. This level of detail is not currently made public by Federal OSHA, and it's unclear, in my opinion, why it's needed, especially given what is currently made public about the citation and the required posting at the construction site already. The immediate publicizing of all details related to citations could create the appearance of guilty until proven innocent for that named contractor. There are many times when a citation is issued and that contractor raises an affirmative defense or wants to appeal the citation, and then the adjudicatory process can go forward. When that happens and the contractor is successful on that appeal, penalties and fines may be reduced or not levied at all. But if this section of the bill is enacted, I can envision scenarios when certain stakeholders take that detailed and publicly available citation and engage in smear campaigns against that contractor, even if the allegations and citations aren't formally adjudicated at that point in time. So we've heard the department today mention several times the need for conformity with federal law as well as with other state OSHA type programs. One area that we're unfortunately not going to be seeing in this conformity is the aligning our state's youth employment laws for construction that the Federal Wage and Hour Division has, as well as all of our surrounding states. Currently in Minnesota, anybody under 18, with a few very small exceptions, are prohibited from working in construction sites, while our surrounding states and federal law allow 16 and 17 year olds to work in construction sites. Both merit shop and union contractors in these surrounding states and throughout the country are having success at hiring, teaching, and placing these young adults safely on construction sites. So we hope to continue that conversation on youth employment with this committee later this session. And I am happy to answer any questions the committee members may have about the bill before us today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Please stick around in case there's questions for you. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, after listening to these two testifiers, they brought up an issue that I was concerned about all along, and that is these citations being public and being public before due process, for no better way of putting it. These contractors deserve a due process, just like both of the testifiers have said. How do you feel about that? I think this is going to affect a lot of people in a negative way, and I think it could really open the state up for a lot of lawsuits.
Commissioner Robertson. Commissioner Robertson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can certainly appreciate my apologies. There's such a delay, I don't know if I'm being called upon. I apologize. Mr. Chair, Representative, I certainly can appreciate the concerns of those testifying. However, as Adam mentioned, this information is available on the federal website. So although this would be new activity for Minnesota OSHA, the activity is currently taking place. We are required to provide that information promptly to federal OSHA, and federal OSHA then can post it on their website. And so I do not believe that it will be detrimental to employers because the information is already out there. The challenge for Minnesota OSHA is that we are prohibited from sharing or discussing or posting the information.
Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the other part of my question, Commissioner, I guess I'm concerned that if the agency doesn't do an absolute perfect job, you're going to be opening yourself up to a lot of lawsuits. Have you thought about that? Have you put some money in place to defend those lawsuits, because they're coming?
Commissioner Robertson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, we have not set aside money for lawsuits. We believe that if it is allowed, if this provision succeeds and is allowed by law, then there would not be lawsuits around it because it would be allowed by law. So I wouldn't understand what the basis of the lawsuit would be.
Representative Poston.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative, I saw Representative Bliss had his hands up. Did you take that down? If you did, Representative Brawley has his hand up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Poston covered my questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bliss. Representative Brawley.
Two questions with two parts. First question is, what is the citation process, and what happens if the citation is appealed?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the department, currently the Department of Labor shares information with Federal OSHA on a regular basis. If there are changes to those citations, that information is reported and opening is posted.
Representative Raleigh.
Mr. Chair, I guess my question was, what is the citation process? Who can initiate that? And then how does your body investigate that? And then the second question was, what happens if it's appealed? Does it go through, on appeal, does it go through your department that you have oversight over? Or does it go to a third party trusted source? Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Robertson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe your question is, how is the appeal process handled? It was breaking up, so I didn't get all your words. If your question is, what is the internal process, I would be happy to walk you through that. An inspection takes place. The inspection, there is an internal review to ensure that the proposed citations are appropriate. So there is oversight within the agency as the investigation file moves along the process. After the investigation is completed, the file is wrapped up in terms of whether or not any citations would be issued. The investigation file moved along. If citations are determined to be appropriate, those citations are issued. When citations are issued, employers are given 20 days to appeal that citation. They can contest the citation itself or the monetary fines associated with those citations. If the citations are contested, then employers are invited for an informal conference within the agency, seeking to give the employer the opportunity to bring forth additional information or have additional discussion. If there is no resolution, if no resolution comes out of the informal conference, the investigation file would be referred to the Attorney General's office for investment.
Representative Raleigh.
Mr. Chair, final question. So how do we protect businesses from being, in our culture, being canceled or publicly shamed prior to full adjudication? And then the second part of that is, what do you feel we should do in order to make sure that we protect the state's liability from disclosing this information prior to full adjudication? Mr. Chair, that was my final question.
Representative Roberts, or Commissioner Robertson. I don't know if she caught all that question, Representative Raleigh. Can we try to get that answer offline?
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for the opportunity. If she's not able to hear the question, I do think it's important. Mr. Chair, I absolutely want to protect workers' rights. I think that's, you know, part of our mission here. I'm afraid that this bill just doesn't do that, and I didn't get the answers I was looking for. And unfortunately, because of that, I can't support this bill at this time.
Thank you, Representative Raleigh. I believe that a lot of these questions are going to be addressed when it makes its next stop at the Judiciary and Civil Law Committee as well. Commissioner Robertson, if you could get with Representative Raleigh and discuss those concerns with him on this bill, I'd appreciate it. Is there any other member questions? Seeing none, Representative Frederick renews his motion that the bill be House File 334 be referred to Judiciary and Finance and Civil Law. Ms. Doyle, will you please take the roll?
Chair Eklund?
Yes.
Eklund, aye. Vice Chair Zhang?
Yes.
Zhang, aye. Detmer excused. Representative McDonald? Representative McDonald? Representative Berg?
Yes.
Berg, aye. Representative Bliss?
No.
Bliss, no. Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Edelson, aye. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Poston?
No.
Poston, no. Representative Raleigh?
No.
Raleigh, no. Representative Sundin?
Aye.
Sundin, aye. Representative McDonald? Representative McDonald, if you are there, you are muted. I have 8 ayes, 3 nays, and 2 absent.
Thank you, Ms. Doyle. With 8 ayes, 3 nays, Representative Frederick, you're on your way to the bill. It moves on to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Members and staff, our next meeting is tomorrow, February 10th, and we have 4 bills on the agenda. Any questions or concerns? And thank you for your patience today. Obviously, we had some technical difficulties going through. So seeing no questions or concerns, we'll see you tomorrow. We are adjourned.